Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with how much of an advantage Hillary Clinton will have over Donald Trump in terms of her foreign policy expertise and whether that will matter and be a focus of the general election campaign. Dr. Stephen Walt, Professor of International Relations at Harvard University's Kennedy School of Government, joins us to discuss his article at Foreign Policy, The Donald versus the Blob. The foreign policy establishment is backing Hillary Clinton, and that may not be such a bad thing for Trump. We will also examine the recent failures of the foreign policy elite and the lack of accountability for their mistakes, which may explain why people are supporting, quote, a xenophobic, nativist, vulgar, and impulsive bomb thrower, as Stephen Walt describes Donald Trump. Then we'll look into the growing economic and political crisis in Venezuela, where the oil-rich country is beset by staggering inflation, uncontrolled violence, food shortages, looting, power cuts, social polarization, and political paralysis. David Smildy, a senior fellow at the Washington Office of Latin America specializing in Venezuela, joins us from Caracas, Venezuela, along with Miguel Tinker Salas, a professor and chair of Latin American history at Pomona College and author of Venezuela, What Everyone Needs to Know. Together, they will discuss what has gone wrong in Venezuela and whether it can be fixed from the outside as long as Venezuelans are not engaged in dialogue and negotiation. Then finally, while Republicans remain bitterly divided over Donald Trump as the GOP standard bearer, we'll examine the growing fratricide on the Democratic side between Bernie Sanders and his supporters and Hillary Clinton, who is mathematically all but certain to be the party's presidential nominee. Ed Kilgore, a political columnist for New York Magazine and the managing editor of the Democratic Strategist, joins us to discuss the current squabble between the Sanders campaign and the head of the DNC, who's accused of throwing shade on Bernie from the beginning, and the call by the Sanders campaign for another debate between the two candidates on Fox News before the June 7th primary in California. And joining us now is Dr. Stephen Walt, Professor of International Affairs at Harvard University's Kennedy School of Government and the author of The Origins of Alliances, Revolution and War, Taming American Power, The Global Response to U.S. Primacy, and co-authored with John Mearsheimer, The Israel Lobby and U.S. Foreign Policy. His latest article at Foreign Policy is The Donald versus the Blob. The foreign policy establishment is backing Hillary Clinton, and that may not be such a bad thing for Trump. Welcome to Background Briefing, Dr. Stephen Walt.
Nice to talk with you, Ian.
And you start your article out with the appropriate caveat that the two candidates could not be more different, female versus male, longtime public servant versus self-absorbed private businessman, Democrat versus Republican, unapologetic liberal internationalist versus xenophobic nativist, uber-cautious, poll-driven politico versus vulgar and impulsive bomb thrower. It seems to me, perhaps even go further, given that this is the year of the political outsider, with the status quo politicians having a hard time against populist insurgents, criticism of Hillary Clinton does seem trite compared to the unmitigated disaster that Donald Trump poses. I mean, he's against everything that is vital for our survival, like dealing with climate change, which Trump denies. Everything that's needed, like gun control, healthcare reform, living wages, nuclear disarmament, and Wall Street reform. And he would stack the Supreme Court with reactionaries so that none of the challenges we face will be dealt with, thus ensuring our national decline and the planet's collapse. I know that's maybe my opinion there, but I'm sure there are a lot of people that would agree with me.
Yes, I think that that's a pretty extreme view, but certainly a Trump presidency is a giant social science experiment that I would prefer not to run. I think the fact of the matter is we don't know exactly what he would do as president. He's changed his position so often already during the campaign. We do know that he doesn't understand a lot of critical issues very well. We know he's impulsive. I think there are reasons to question his character in some pretty fundamental ways. And, of course, we have no idea who he would appoint to critical positions, not just the Supreme Court, but, you know, everything from Secretary of Defense, Secretary of State, National Security Advisor on down. There are hundreds of key positions that a president picks, and we don't know who any of those people would be. So, as I said, a Trump presidency is, I think, a enormous roll of the dice, and one that I hope the American people steadfastly reject come November.
But clearly, Trump's popularity and the fact that he has a following indicates that there's a restiveness, to say the least. And I guess the point that you're making here is that it's pretty hard to defend the foreign policy elite, let alone the domestic policy elite. Go ahead.
Yeah, no, that's right. I mean, what's clear in 2016 and the Trump campaign, and I would say on the Democratic side, the Sanders campaign, are both, I think, evidence of a fairly widespread dislike, distaste, distrust with the political establishment, the sense that there is an elite set of fat cats who are well-positioned, well-connected, doing very well in the current system, and ultimately don't care all that much about the country at large, and that are conducting themselves in a way that has not been particularly successful. And that applies as well to foreign policy. Again, for all of my reservations and, in fact, deep opposition to a Trump candidacy, if you look at the record of the past 25 years or so and what American foreign policy has done, and that's been a foreign policy that's by and large been embraced by Democrats and Republicans alike, it's not a very successful foreign policy. But you would normally think that having lots of foreign policy insiders lined up on her side would be a huge advantage for Hillary. And I think in a normal election, that would be the case. You know, she's really got dozens of very experienced mainstream officials backing her campaign, including, I might add, a whole lot of Republicans who have said, you know, never Trump. But this year, 2016, is a somewhat different year, and having all those establishment figures is not the advantage that you might have normally predicted.
And the point that you make is quite fundamental, and that is that with the end of the Cold War, the U.S. was in the catbird seat, and just a few decades later, our foreign policy is in shambles. You know, we've gone through these, you know, completely wasted $6 to $8 trillion unsuccessful wars in Iraq and Afghanistan with no end in sight. I'm just quickly reading some of your points. Failure to achieve an Israeli-Palestinian peace accord arrangement and failure to build a positive relationship with Russia, mostly because of NATO expansion into Russia's sphere of influence and the inability to stop North Korea, India, and Pakistan from acquiring nuclear weapons and then producing failed states in Libya, Yemen, and Syria. But the point that you make, though, you trace this from, essentially, it went off the rails with 9/11. And what I find interesting is that you also make the point that the 9/11 Commission shied away from holding anybody responsible. And we know that Robert Zelikow, who led that, was basically in the bag for Condoleezza Rice, and they backed away from a lot of stuff, including Saudi Arabia's involvement, which has now got the Senate passing a special resolution. So it seems to me that the point you're making is that it's a two-pronged problem. One, our terrible foreign policy mistakes, and two, the lack of accountability and culpability.
Yeah, I think that's right. I'd make two points. First, the problems actually don't begin with 9/11. The problems begin in the 1990s, in the Clinton administration, Bill Clinton administration. But Bill was lucky. First of all, he didn't take any big risks like an invasion of Iraq, no large-scale use of force, as he famously appointed, no ground troops. And the problems that he helped produce come home to roost under George W. Bush. It was things like NATO expansion and dual containment and other elements like that that helped bring about some of the problems that then Bush makes worse himself. The second point I'd make is the one you ended with, which is that throughout this establishment is a real aversion to accountability. So you mentioned the 9/11 Commission, which doesn't name any names, doesn't hold anyone personally responsible. No one except enlisted officials and one-star general are held accountable for Abu Ghraib prison, the abuses there, even though it's clear that the responsibility for what was going on there went much higher up, possibly all the way to the Secretary of Defense. No one's been held accountable for the American use of torture as part of the war on terror. And in fact, attempts to even get at the bottom of what the CIA and others were doing in that period have been blocked at almost every turn. We still don't have the full Senate report, for example, and may never, the public may never get a chance to see this. And then I just had one other thing, which is the sort of failing upward tendencies within this establishment. We have situations where lots of public officials come in, do a pretty terrible job, in some cases break the law, and yet go back out of power and then back into power later on. So we don't have a situation where we're rewarding success and holding people accountable for failure. And if that's the case, it's pretty hard to imagine how you're going to do better over time or how you're going to learn properly from your mistakes so that you can perform in a more satisfactory way down the road.
And again, I'm speaking with Dr. Stephen Walters, Professor of International Affairs at Harvard University's Kennedy School of Government and the author of The Origins of Alliances, Revolution and War, Taming American Power, The Global Response to U.S. Primacy, and co-authored with John Mearsheimer, The Israel Lobby and U.S. Foreign Policy. And his latest article at Foreign Policy is The Donald versus the Blob. The foreign policy establishment is backing Hillary Clinton, and that may not be such a bad thing for Trump. So why is it then that you know, as you point out in your article, Stephen Walt, why is it that just like Wall Street, the establishment, the foreign policy establishment, rarely holds its members accountable? Much, of course, of the disasters in Afghanistan and Iraq, and it's unquestionable that the historical verdict on Iraq is that it's unraveled most of the Middle East, and the problems we have today can be directly traced to that ill-fated misadventure. The neocons have been largely blamed for it, but Hillary Clinton, John Kerry, they all voted for it. What explains that? Is this just, you know, like a kind of old-fashioned gentleman's club that we're talking about here?
Well, there may be an element of that to it, but I think it has several dimensions. One, I think inside the Beltway, there is, in fact, a bipartisan consensus on foreign policy. If you go to both parties or if you go to most of the major think tanks and policy organizations inside Washington, they all believe in a policy of liberal hegemony, that the United States is the world's indispensable nation, that we have the right responsibility and wisdom to run politics in almost every corner of the world, that, you know, absent American leadership on every issue, the whole world completely falls apart. And so there's an intellectual consensus to start with, even though the attempt to manage local politics all over the world has not been doing very well. In fact, it's been a disaster time and time again. Second, I think, you know, there's an old adage in politics to go along, get along, or to get along, go along, that you don't want to make any permanent enemies. You don't want to hold people accountable because then someone might hold you accountable when you're in power. And you even saw this at the level of President Obama when he declared, you know, he wasn't going to hold anyone in the Bush administration accountable for torture or for violating international and domestic law. He was going to look forward, not back. And I think that temptation is very real for people inside the establishment to sort of get along, even though you disagree on some minor political issues. You're all essentially part of the same team. And I think once you have got a sort of insider mentality like that, it's very difficult to make the kind of judgments that are necessary to get the best performance. One final point is, this happens in part because ultimately the consequences for the United States have not been that great. I mean, yes, we've squandered an enormous amount of money. We have lost thousands of soldiers killed and wounded. But for most Americans, they don't feel these as immediate and tangible failures. It's much more indirect and intangible in the form of eroding infrastructure, school performance that's declining. But that's something that people don't connect to some of these foreign policy failures. And if they did, they would probably demand a higher standard of performance.
Well, the one area of foreign policy that does strike a raw nerve, and I think your point's well taken, of course, is terrorism. And And a lot of analysts say that if there were to be a terrorist attack, either a big one in Europe or one here in the United States, in, say, October, it could swing the election for Trump. Now, that presupposes a kind of psychological condition in this country, which I, for the life of me, I do not understand. But history indicates that we have been whipsawed by actors from the Middle East, like Sirhan Sirhan, who killed Bobby Kennedy and changed the political landscape with and helped elect Nixon. Then you had under Carter, you had this obscure character, the Ayatollah Khamenei, who essentially helped elect Reagan. And there's no question that Bush, in many ironic ways, benefited from bin Laden and then from Saddam Hussein, who was this sort of nemesis that they created, etc. So this is a puzzlement that I've always had, you know, that we can get whipsawed by obscure actors in the Middle East, and we're vulnerable to that. And it raises the fundamental question of how much do we control our own political destiny?
Yeah, well, I would take a couple of points. First of all, one of the reasons we keep getting blowback from places in the Middle East and some other parts of the world too, but mostly the Middle East in recent years, is of course that we keep interfering there. We keep going and trying to reorganize these societies and topple particular leaders and then put something back together. And of course, we have no idea how to do that. And what we do is create enormous local resentment at what we're doing. And we also create places where we've destroyed the existing political institutions. There's nothing there to control things. And you get something like ISIS emerging. That's problem number one. Problem number two, of course, is that we greatly exaggerate the danger that these movements pose. ISIS is a problem. There are some people who have tragically lost their lives as a result of its actions. Fortunately, not large numbers, particularly relative to many other dangers that Americans and others face. But we treat it as though, of course, it's the second coming of the Third Reich or a grand existential threat to everything we hold dear. And I think this is primarily a failure of leadership. American politicians have been quick to hype the threat from groups like ISIS or previously al-Qaeda, and not to keep that threat in perspective because it was useful to have Americans scared. And I think also much of American media has contributed to that. So even a small terrorist incident someplace gets enormous coverage, 24/7 treatment. You know, CNN will go bananas with Fox will go bananas. And that leads people to think that these things are more common and more ominous than they really are. So it's, I think, a combination of failures of political leadership and irresponsible media behavior that have made us vulnerable to the kind of whipsawing or sensitivity that you're warning against.
Well, Stephen Walt, it does seem, though, that we have a situation here where, given the people that you've named as the foreign policy advisors of Hillary Clinton, her massive brain trust of policy wonks and former government officials, none of them seem all that interesting, frankly. And one of them, the brightest people in come out of U.S. foreign policy, the sort of dean of diplomacy, Chaz Freeman, has written an extraordinary article. He actually gave a talk at the Carnegie Endowment, but the extract from it is amazing in the insight. You know, as you know, he went to China with Nixon's translator in China and speaks Arabic as well as Mandarin. One of these rare people that, guess what, he couldn't get the job is that Obama wanted him to be head of, you know, his intelligence, you know, flow, the in charge of the National Intelligence Council. And he got vetoed. So there's something structural about, it seems, about our government that mediocre Peter Principle types rise to the top and brilliant people like Chaz get sidelined.
I couldn't agree more about the specific case here. I mean, he is, in fact, a brilliant and very dedicated public servant. And it was a tragedy that that Obama decided to withdraw his nomination to head the National Intelligence Council. And that's right. You know, you can't have a better government than the people within it. And that means you need to get people with widely varying views, but who are all, you know, committed to the well-being of the United States. And then you want to have in public a wide-ranging, lively debate on a lot of these questions. And by the way, I think the American people would like to see that, too. There was a survey done by the Pew Foundation about a month ago that said roughly 57% of the American people now believe the United States should focus primarily on its own problems and let others do the best they can. 47% felt the United States was doing too much in the world. Only 27% thought we were doing too little. This is not an argument for isolationism, but it's an argument for a much smarter and more selective and more rational way of dealing with the rest of the world, and in particular, one that doesn't rely primarily upon military force to solve what are essentially political problems.
Well, Dr. Stephen Walt, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Pleasure talking with you, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with Dr. Stephen Walt, who is Professor of International Affairs at Harvard University's Kennedy School of Government. He's the author of The Origins of Alliances, Revolution and War, Taming American Power, The Global Response to U.S. Primacy, and co-authored with John Mearsheimer, The Israel Lobby and U.S. Foreign Policy. His latest article at Foreign Policy is The Donald versus the Blob. The foreign policy establishment is backing Hillary Clinton, and that may not be such a bad thing for Trump. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back looking into the growing economic and political crisis in Venezuela.
Está viejo y cansado, pero no se dan de cuenta que un corazón amarrado, cuando le sueltan las riendas, es caballo desbocado. Y si una potra la sana, caballo viejo se encuentra, el pecho se le desgrana y no le hace caso a falseta, y no le obedece a freno ni lo paran falsas riendas.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24-7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now from Caracas, Venezuela, is David Smiley, a senior fellow at the Washington Office of Latin America, specializing in Venezuela, and a professor of sociology at Tulane University. Professor Smiley has researched Venezuela for the past 20 years and has lived there for a total of 10 years, during which time he taught at the Universidad Central de Venezuela and the Universidad Católica Andrés Bello. He moderates the blog Venezuela Politics and Human Rights. And also joining us is Miguel Tinker Salas, the professor and chair of Latin American History and Chicana Latina Studies at Pomona College in Claremont, California, an authority on political and social issues confronting Latin America. He's the author of Venezuela, What Everyone Needs to Know, The Enduring Legacy, Oil Culture and Society in Venezuela, and co-editor with Steve Elner of Venezuela, Hugo Chavez and the Decline of an Exceptional Democracy. Welcome to Background Briefing, David Smiley and Miguel Tinker Salas.
Thank you.
And let me start with David in Caracas, just to sort of get a sense of where we stand now. The President Maduro has predicted that the opposition-controlled parliament will soon disappear. I'm not sure what he means by that, but you've got, of course, the country racked with food shortages, power cuts, violence, shrinking economy, and the world's highest rate of inflation. Last Friday, I believe, Maduro declared a state of emergency, but the parliament refused to pass it. And they're pushing a referendum to recall Maduro for mismanagement. And for now, it seems that Maduro has the upper hand because of his control of the Supreme Court and the election authorities. They support the government and they can overrule the parliament in terms of this state of emergency and also stop any recall vote. So at this point, it seems that Maduro can put off the referendum. If he can put off the referendum till next year, it'll have a more limited impact. But if it happens this year, it would trigger an election. And so it's better that for him that it happens next year, because he could simply allow his deputy to take over. So is that a fair summary of the situation?
Yeah, that was quite good. Maduro said the National Assembly's days are counted yesterday. That was in the context of suggesting that they weren't going to pass his state of exception, and he was correct about that. So I think that was sort of a threat. It's still not something that he's done. I think the state of exception, in fact, what it does is it's sort of like an enabling law that gives the executive branch powers to sort of bypass the Congress on certain issues. I think definitely Maduro has the upper hand right now. institutional power because he has a Supreme Court. I would say, however, that the National Electoral Council, at least last year and in previous years, has shown some degree of independence. Clearly it has a bias towards Chavismo and the government. But last year they held elections in which the opposition won two-thirds of the seats, and actually it was quite evident that that was going to happen beforehand. Nevertheless, they held them. So I think if the opposition pushes hard and jumps through all its hoops, I think, you know, there's a 50-50 chance that they will actually be able to do it this year.
And Miguel Tincasalas, there were, of course, protests and rallies in across Venezuela today with the security forces firing tear gas at protesters in Caracas. But given some of the problems that the public have been facing, which I briefly outlined, it would seem to me that it's a surprise that the government hasn't fallen. I mean, I think if these conditions existed in the U.S., the whole political class would have been booted out. So what explains the fact that there seems to be still support for Maduro, given the problems the country's facing?
Well, one of the comments in Venezuela is that sometimes the opposition is the best ally which the government has, because, in fact, the opposition is united in trying to oust Maduro, no doubt about that. But there isn't really a concrete proposal on the part of the opposition to tackle some of the real structural problems that Venezuelan faces. When pushed on the matter of how to address the question of development, given the fact that the dependence on oil is not going to pull the country out of this doldrums, there's very little answer except to streamline production, except to professionalize the apparatus. But the reality is there's no real solid answer. And the population, I think, is still a bit leery about proposals that are going to essentially empower an opposition that would be given a carte blanche to rewrite the economy. They have benefited from some of the social programs over the last 15 years. They've seen some change into their lifestyle and their standard of living. So I think there's some resistance on that part. And to the extent to which the opposition is unable to really concretely make proposals on how to address inflation, how to address the impossible exchange rates, how to address crime, how to alter the economy in ways that are going to be inclusive for broad sectors of the population while at the same time addressing the problem of shortages, I think that they really cannot convert the larger discontent into a political force beyond simply discontent. We see the discontent, that's evident, that's obvious, and it's legitimate on so many multiple levels.
So there in Caracas, David Smiley, what's your answer then to this apparent paradox that conditions are bad and getting worse, and yet the government still has popularity and the opposition seems feckless?
Well, I think, first off, I think I might disagree a little bit in the sense that I don't think the government is all that popular anymore. I mean, I think it's impressive that in December they got 42% of the vote, and that was an impressive show. You know, and Maduro held on to about through January and February. The last numbers we have are from March that say he was at 26-27%. So there's been a really significant deterioration in the past 2 months in terms of scarcity and in terms of electricity blackouts. I suspect the next numbers we see are going to have his popularity down to around 20%. People are really upset, and I think, I would totally agree that the opposition does not really have a positive message. In other words, it doesn't have a proposal that has something to say or what it's going to do. But at this point, I don't think it really needs one. What it really needs is its focus, its message on a referendum, on a recall referendum, organize and mobilize people and gain their trust. And I think, you know, it's really going to depend on them jumping through the hoops, showing some strength in the streets, and seeing whether the CNE, I think it's really in the hands of the CNE, whether they're going to get to this referendum. I think, you know, there hasn't been any kind of mass protest or rebellion, in part because over the past year, the government has quite assiduously policed protests. I mean, if you go to the supermarket just down the street here, sometimes I go running at 6 in the morning, and there will be 5 or 6 National Guardsmen who are there controlling the line. They pass out numbers and make sure everything happens and tell people where to stand and whatnot. So whenever there's cases that are protest or looting, they usually put those down pretty quickly, and I think they've pretty much been able to keep these protests atomized. How long they're going to be able to do that, I'm not sure, because I think as things get worse and people get more desperate, and I think they're getting significantly worse, and they're going to get even worse, or even more worse in the next months, it's not clear to me that they're going to be able to keep control of it.
So, Miguel Tincasalas, if this is the trajectory, then the government would seem to need to come up with some kind of plan here. If it's been on a steady decline now for a few years, Are you aware of any plans to reverse things, or apart from rhetoric?
No, I think beyond the rhetoric, we haven't seen much. In fact, Maduro's position in terms of these special powers is really more of the same. Take over factories, but you don't have inputs with which to actually run the factories and make and produce goods. They really have to tackle this head on. They have to address the dependence on oil, which is a structural problem. And I think both sides suffer from amnesia on this issue. And they think and they keep proposing that oil is going to actually reboot the economy. It's not. They have to tackle inflation. They have to tackle the absurd exchange rate. They have to tackle the subsidy system. You have to tackle the economy by removing some of these cost controls that exist on production. And they have to tackle the question of crime. But those are concrete issues that I think both sides need to be able to focus on. And what's tragic about this this conversation in Venezuela is that both sides are playing to their political base without addressing fundamentally how to address these issues so that this is not repeated over and over and over again.
And David Smiley in Caracas. Is there a foreign component to this? Is there anything that neighbors can do, or is there anything that the U.S. could do, or more to the point, is there anything that the U.S. is doing that's not helpful?
Well, I think, that's an important issue. I think it's going to be hard for any kind of solution to happen in the coming year without some sort of third-party mediation or push. I think the United States is definitely not the country to do this. I think, in fact, the United States has no useful unilateral role in Venezuela. I think they can definitely do things like talk to allies and encourage multilateral solutions, encourage the Vatican, things like that. But, I don't think the United States has any useful role right now. I think if you look at the last time there was interesting political dynamic and negotiation, it was in 2014, and that really began with UNASUR countries. Responding to the protests and encouraging Venezuela strongly encouraging Venezuela that they take on a serious dialogue. And that's when Venezuela was able to do that. And they also did it with the Vatican mediation. The Vatican has, in the past 2 months, made a number of statements suggesting that they are willing to fulfill that role. They haven't really received a response from the government so far. But the real silence so far has come from UNASUR countries, and part of that is because, there's just a lot of change right now. Of course, Brazil is beset by its own problems. Argentina just had a change in power, and all the countries are facing their own difficulties. And so UNASUR hasn't taken action. I think if they were to that would probably be the most important place that a push would come from, and to get the Venezuelan government to accept Vatican mediation. I honestly don't see that happening in the short term or really even the medium term, but I think definitely within the next year there's going to have to be something like that.
So, Miguel Tincasales, do you see any kind of outside influence that might be able to help mitigate the situation? It seems in terms of foreign policy, the Obama administration paradoxically seems to be doing well with Cuba, but largely ignoring Venezuela, except for that the sanctions that they put on a year or so ago against, I think, seven or eight figures in the Maduro government, which I think everybody universally seems to agree that they backfired. So perhaps David Smiley's comment that the less the U.S. does, the better. But on the other hand, somebody's got to help out, surely.
I think you're right. I think that the sanctions that were used when the relations with Cuba were quote unquote normalized. But again, the sanctions were used recently because the U.S. government wanted to have the ambassador to Mexico, and it was being held up by Rubio. And the U.S. government agreed to reinstate the sanctions. I think the U.S. best position would be to stay out. I think that there has to be some other form of mediation. It has to come from within the region. It probably will not come from the Organization of American States because that's seen in Venezuela as being very partial. So I think the solution would have to come from within either the CELAC, which is the community of Latin American and Caribbean nations, through the UNASUR, the Union of South American Nations, or an interlocutor like the Vatican. Remind again that in 2003 and 2004, you had Jimmy Carter serving as an interlocutor in the context of a national strike and an effort at a recall against Chavez in 2003 and 2004. And that provided some mediation, some facilitation. There isn't a figure like that now, except in Pope Francis, and that may be something that might be productive and useful in the context of Venezuela in order to create the conditions. But again, Venezuela is extremely polarized, and the conditions are quickly disinvolving very quickly. So I think that the time for this is short, and conditions are continuing to deteriorate.
So given what Miguel just said, David Smalley, is there a possibility that things could spin out of control? You've got vigilantism, you've got, I understand that armed gangs control the prisons, the highest crime rate, extraordinary inflation, you've got restive population queuing up for hours for staples, etc. Is there a breaking point that is evident to you there in Caracas?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, one of the very basic points of social movements research, the research on social movements and protests, is that people experiencing difficulties, people suffering, is not enough to cause a rebellion. You need a couple other factors. You need a real sense of injustice. I think people increasingly have that. You need organization. I think lacking so far. I need opportunity. I think that's lacking so far also. I think increasingly the discourse of the economic war is falling on deaf ears. I think average Venezuelans think, well, there could be an economic war, but that doesn't mean that we should not have food. I think, you know, I think that rhetoric is wearing a little bit thin. I do think that the security that has, you know, the policing of protests over the past year has really kept us from getting out of control. I think in 2014, there were a number of students and organizers that were arrested enough that there's enough fear to protest that it just takes, you know, it would take quite a bit. I don't think you have the same conditions in 2014 in which there were actually opposite parties and movements organizing the protests. And there's just a lot more fear right now. That said, you know, I think these things are very unpredictable. And I think all it would take really is for the National Guard to overreact and open fire in one of these protests or looting. And that could really generate some nationwide outrage, you know, if you get out of control that way. Or for them, at a certain point, for one of these protests or looting to just get too big and them just kind of sit back and let it go, which is basically what happened in 1989 at the Caracas. So I think there's a number of ways that, indeed, things could get out of hand. I mean, I haven't seen it. It hasn't happened, and we've had lootings almost daily and protests almost daily for the past year. But I think things are getting qualitatively worse, and how long people are willing to do this, it's not clear to me. I think it's getting much worse, and the Venezuelans are not used to not being hungry.
So, Miguel Tinkasalas, given the picture that David Smalley is giving us from Caracas, and given the track record of U.S. foreign policy, where we've broken states like Iraq, we've ignored the plight of Syria till it's reached the point almost of no return, we're not particularly proactive. But this would be the moment, wouldn't it, for the international community and the neighborhood to be proactive if the country could spiral out of control.
I think that the limitations are in some ways ideological. That is, the Venezuelan government will probably never accept mediation with the United States because, again, the history of the U.S.-Venezuelan relations. So I think it has to come from within the region. I think it has to seek some way of trying to resolve the impasse. But I think that the larger question is that, again, it has to come from within Venezuelans. I mean, this is a time to actually have a conversation about how to resolve these real structural issues. The problems of Venezuela face are not unique to Chavismo. They're not unique to the opposition. They are part of the structural problems that Venezuela has faced historically. This is not the first time Venezuela has faced a crisis. We should remember what brought Hugo Chavez to power in the first place. It was oil at $7 a barrel. It was a structural crisis. It was the same crisis we visited in 1989, and it was a crisis we saw through into the 1980s. In fact, Venezuela has lived a series of economic crises because oil continues to be a volatile resource with which to be able to grow an economy. So until there's a national conversation and a willingness to engage openly on these issues and to recognize that there is more in common here than there is against it, this will be a very difficult conversation to resolve. That said, I think that any help in trying to mediate this has to come from within the region itself or from within the institutions that exist in the region, such as UNASUR and the CELAC, or other such institutions.
So just a last-minute comment from David Smiley, particularly on what Miguel just said in terms of the need for the Venezuelans to start talking to each other.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's absolutely true. If you look at the last poll I saw, it was really interesting that the local polling company finally found a question in which there's a broad consensus. They asked people, what do you think the relationship with the National Assembly and the executive is going to be? And approximately 85% said that they thought it was going to be conflictive this year. They said, what would you like the relationship to be? And 93% across the board, whether they're independent, government supporter, or government opponent, said that they wanted the National Assembly and the executive branch to work together. And so I think, you know, Venezuela has seen a situation of polarization, political polarization, in which it's the extremes that get most of the press, both, you know, the extreme to opposition position that denies the legitimacy of Chavismo, and the sort of extreme Leninist type position that embodies one branch or one wing of Chavismo. In the middle, most Venezuelans tend not to be very ideological. They want to live well. They want to live, you know, in peace, and they want to, they're basically family. People are not strongly ideological. And so I think they just want things to get better. And I think that's what has to happen. And it's really easy, I think, for politicians to lose sight of that in the struggle for power.
And Miguel Tinkasalas, a last word from you.
Well, I think critical is politics is not, it cannot be a zero-sum game. The reality is that there has to be a proposal on both sides that grapple with the fundamental problems that Venezuelan faces. They cannot be simply done for political gain. They have to be done with a long-term view of how Venezuela resolves its dependence on oil and how it addresses the very serious structural issues and the volatility of that society, of that economic model.
And again, I've been speaking with Miguel Tinkasalas, who's a professor and chair of Latin American History and Chicana Latina Studies at Pomona College in Claremont, California, an authority on political and social issues confronting Latin America. He's the author of Venezuela, What Everyone Needs to Know, The Enduring Legacy, Oil, Culture, and Society in Venezuela, and co-editor with Steve Elner of Venezuela, Hugo Chavez, and the Decline of an Exceptional Democracy. And also joining us from Caracas, Venezuela, was David Smiley, a senior fellow at the Washington Office of Latin America, specializing in Venezuela and professor of sociology at Tulane University. Professor Smiley has researched Venezuela for the past 20 years and lived there for a total of 10, during which time he taught at the Universidad Central de Venezuela and the Universidad Católica Andrés Bello. He moderates the blog Venezuelan Politics and Human Rights. We're going to take a brief station break and back examining the growing fratricide on the Democratic side between Bernie Sanders and his supporters and Hillary Clinton. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Ed Kilgore, a political columnist for New York Magazine, the managing editor of The Democratic Strategist, an online forum, and a senior fellow at the Progressive Policy Institute. He was formerly vice president for policy at the Democratic Leadership Council, communications director for U.S. Senator Sam Nunn, and a federal state relations staffer for three governors of Georgia. His latest article at New York Magazine is Sanders needs to talk down his supporters and explain that nothing is being stolen. Welcome to Background Briefing, Ed Kilgore.
Thanks a lot, Ian.
And in terms of the idea that this race between Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton, to many people, it's sort of whistling past the graveyard because mathematics don't lie, and it's almost mathematically impossible for Bernie Sanders to get the nomination. What people are concerned about is the growing animus. You've got a spat going on now between the DNC head, Debbie Wasserman Schultz, and Bernie Sanders' top campaign people, who have argued that she's always been throwing shade on them to help Hillary, and there may well be some substance to that. And now the Sanders campaign wants a debate in California. So what's your sense of, are the Democrats going off the rails here when they have an extraordinary opportunity to take on a Republican candidate that a lot of Republicans really don't want and have been doing their best to stop him?
Well, I don't know if they're going off the rails, but I do think there are some reasons for concern among Democrats, and also some pretty legitimate tough questions being asked of Bernie Sanders, which I sort of did in my piece too. There are kind of two things you were hearing now. Is, you know, first, what's the end game for Bernie Sanders? He's been very cagey about acknowledging what everybody thought they understood earlier in the race, that the pledged delegate winner should be the nominee. Now he's, on some occasions, he's saying sort of no matter what, he's going to take his campaign all the way to the convention. You know, even if he would require superdelegates to overturn a Hillary Clinton lead in pledged delegates, which, of course, wouldn't happen. The second thing is, you know, the continued and ever more vociferous claims that the contest is rigged, that he's being cheated, and that things like limiting the participation in independents in Democratic Party primaries is part of some sort of, you know, semi-conspiracy to keep him from winning the nomination. And that's the kind of thing that really could make his supporters bitter heading toward the convention. And the fact that it's empirically not true makes it that much more concerning that that Sanders himself and certainly his campaign manager, Mr. Weaver, are indulging themselves in pretty often.
Well, the New York Times had an editorial recently suggesting that it'd be a good thing for the Democratic Party for Bernie Sanders to go all the way to the convention and take his arguments to the convention and see how much he can affect the platform, etc., based upon the idea that as long as things are transparent and open, it doesn't give Bernie Sanders' followers and supporters the opportunity to say that he's been robbed if nobody has clearly robbed him. So that seems to be the situation. But now, instead of it, that being settled, it seems to be the wound seems to be being opened.
Well, I don't quite follow the logic of the New York Times editorial. If the argument is that the actual vote of Democrats and others around the country was rigged because there were closed primaries or something like that, then the logical implication is that the result is illegitimate and should be overturned. And I'm afraid that's what Sanders and his folks are sort of hinting now and then when they, you know, ask superdelegates to reverse the outcome. I mean, he also is spending an awful lot of time, I mean, practically every other breath, citing general election polls showing him running better against Donald Trump than Hillary Clinton, which, again, like the demand for open primaries, is a little ironic. It's usually what you hear party centrists do. But again, it's as though he's making an argument day in and day out for overturning the decision of the popular vote in primaries and caucuses, and that's what's pretty dangerous because I don't know how you satisfy that complaint.
Well, but are there separate issues here? The mathematics of how many delegates you have versus your presence at the convention and what you can leverage in terms of your followers, particularly if they're young and enthusiastic and new voters who've been brought in by Bernie Sanders.
Well, you know, I have a saying that party platforms are the fool's gold of American politics. Nobody has ever in the history of party politics been bound by a platform. Nominees frequently, you know, defy them. I understand why Bernie Sanders and his folks would like to end the campaign on some sort of moral victory. And I strongly suspect that within reason, Hillary Clinton's people will make a lot of concessions on the platform. But when you start demanding things like changing the rules of primary elections, which are for the most part set by states, that's not a demand that can even feasibly be satisfied. And it makes you wonder if the point is something very different. Trying to maintain a grievance beyond the convention, which would not be very good for Democrats, obviously. And it's something that even Bernie Sanders himself might not be able to undo.
And again, I'm speaking with Ed Kilgore, who's a political columnist for New York Magazine, the managing editor of the Democratic Strategist and online forum, and senior fellow at the Progressive Policy Institute. He was formerly vice president for policy and at the Democratic Leadership Council, communications director for U.S. Senator Sam Nunn, and a federal state relations staffer for three governors of Georgia. His latest article at New York Magazine is Sanders Needs to Talk Down His Supporters and Explain That Nothing Is Being Stolen. In terms, though, of the passion of Bernie Sanders' followers, it's pretty evident, isn't it, that these young people in particular that have been drawn to his message are very, very passionate. And, you know, something needs to be done to keep them in the tent, surely. I mean, short of having, you know, Elizabeth Warren as the vice president or whatever. What, in your opinion, Ed Kilgore, what can be done to keep the enthusiasm alive and keep Bernie's voters in the tent?
Well, I have several responses to that. One, this is just a hobby horse of mine. Enthusiasm is a good thing, but you don't get extra votes for it. Any enthusiasm beyond which is necessary to get you to the polls and to vote a certain way is kind of a waste. So let's don't get too crazy about, you know, overvaluing passion and excitement and all that. My second answer is that, sure, I think Elizabeth Warren, as I've written about this too, Elizabeth Warren would be a fine running mate for Hillary Clinton. And the benefits would go beyond, perhaps making, Bernie Sanders supporters happy, though, frankly, when I wrote about that, a lot of Bernie's folks on Twitter were saying that'd be a slap in the face to Bernie. So who knows? Third thing is that if the prospect of a Donald Trump presidency doesn't motivate people to turn out on the Democratic side, if they believe what they say they believe, then nothing on earth will. And there's nothing you can do about it. So, but I think in the end, we heard a lot of this same talk 8 years ago, when Hillary Clinton's people were bitter about a close, tough primary defeat. In the end, it didn't much matter. And I suspect that'll be the case with this if it's kept within limits. I mean, the difference so far is that once it was clear she was defeated, Hillary Clinton did surrender unconditionally and played a very constructive role in the convention. That doesn't seem to be the trajectory of Sanders' campaign at the moment.
So what's your sense then of obviously on the Republican side, there's great alarm about Donald Trump. There's been a Stop Trump movement. Still, it seems that Mitt Romney and a number of prominent Republicans are still casting about trying to find a third party alternative to run as a genuine conservative, as they say, against Trump. Nobody in the party thinks that's a good idea because of it splits the vote. So this is all to say that there's an awful lot of criticism of Donald Trump coming from the Republicans themselves, and the concern seems to be particularly with Paul Ryan, who I think in many ways is trying to get Trump to agree to his agenda as opposed to the other way around. But nevertheless, they appear to be motivated by what they call down-ticket damage. So do you think that there will be the down-ticket damage that's being predicted for the Republicans?
I think it's likely, assuming, you know, Trump does really badly. And I mean, we're already seeing some consolidation of Republican voters behind him. But let's just say, for the sake of argument, he loses by a healthy 8 points or so, which I think is very realistic. I think there'll be some down ballot damage. One of the
things we sort of know is that there's been a trend away from ticket splitting behavior all over the country in the last 10 to 20 years. It's part of the ideological sorting out of the two parties. So I think it's going to be very difficult for Republicans, if Trump does as poorly as a lot of us think, to avoid losing the Senate and losing quite a few House seats, too.
But is there another side of the coin, which is that this fratricide that's going on at this extraordinary historical moment where the Republicans have one of the least qualified candidates in the history of American politics to be president of the United States, or even to be dog catcher, is nevertheless going to be blown, that nobody's particularly enthusiastic about Hillary Clinton, and with Bernie's people piling on and feeling that she may have robbed them, you're just going to have a bunch of bitterness and people aren't going to show up, and lo and behold.
Well, it's always possible, but it's a long time until the general election. Let's remember that. And, and I think so long as there's a dignified end to the Democratic contest, I wouldn't worry too much about divisions. I mean, after all, for all we want to say about Bernie Sanders' tactics right now, he's not calling Hillary Clinton a, egomaniacal madman the way one of the Republican rivals of Donald Trump said. I mean, if you add up all the things that other Republicans have said about Trump, Bernie Sanders, at his most fractious, doesn't even come remotely close to any of it. So let's do keep this in perspective. I think Republicans have a lot more healing to do than Democrats do. It's just at this particular moment, there's a sense a lot of us have that Bernie's starting to drink a little too much of his own Kool-Aid, and it would be nice to see that. He will probably do pretty well down the stretch in delegates, and certainly have earned a significant presence at the convention. But it doesn't have to be fratricide.
Well, just in closing, do you think Bernie Sanders is going to win California?
You know, it's interesting you ask. Everybody seems to assume he will. The dirty little secret is Hillary's led every single poll taken this year and even last year heading into this fight. She has some demographic advantages in California. But, if I had to bet on it, I would say probably Bernie will win, though not by much, and certainly not remotely like the kind of 2-to-1 margin he would need to get close to catching her in pledged delegates.
Well, Ed Kilgour, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with Ed Kilgour, who's a political columnist for New York Magazine, the managing editor of the Democratic Strategist, an online forum, and a senior fellow at the Progressive Policy Institute. He was formerly vice president for policy at the Democratic Leadership Council, communications director of the communications director for U.S. Senator Sam Nunn, and the author of Election 2014, Why the Republicans Swept the Midterms. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down on the right-hand side to subscribe to iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.